pleased, along with the Graduate Council, to welcome Sir John Gurdon as this year's speaker in the Charles M. and Martha Hitchcock Lecture Series. As a condition of this bequest, we're obligated and happy to tell you how the endowment came to UC Berkeley. So at the risk of some repetition from yesterday, it's a story that exemplifies the many ways this campus is linked to the history of California and the Bay Area. Dr. Charles Hitchcock, a physician for the Army, came to San Francisco during the Gold Rush, where he opened a thriving private practice. In 1885, Charles established a professorship here at Berkeley as an expression of his long-held interest in education. His daughter, Lily Hitchcock Coit, still treasured in San Francisco for her colorful personality as well as her generosity, greatly expanded her father's original gift to establish a professorship at UC Berkeley, making it possible for us to present a series of lectures. The Hitchcock Fund has become one of the most cherished endowments of the University of California, recognizing the highest distinction of scholarly thought and achievement. So thank you, Lily and Charles, and now I'd like to say a few words about Sir John Gurdon. We heard his impressive list of honors yesterday, which included, from our parochial United States point of view, election as a foreign associate of the National Academy of Sciences of the USA in 1980. But I'd like to highlight some of his many accomplishments that led to this recognition. Sir John will discuss today his important experiments that demonstrated the constancy of the genome through development. In these, he showed, for example, that a skin cell does not throw away the genes to become muscle or nerve. And so these experiments showed that the nucleus of a specialized cell, if properly reprogrammed, could support development of a whole animal. This really stressed the need to understand how genes were selectively used, selectively transcribed. His experiments using this cloning in amphibians really settled the scientific question of whether different animal cells have the same genes or not. And it remained not so much a scientific question, but a technological one of whether the same would be true of mammals. And of course, it took a couple of decades before this was finally shown. Following his experiments in the 60s and 70s, on early 70s, on cloning of amphibians, his work became important to molecular biologists through his demonstration that purified messenger RNAs were very efficiently expressed after they've been injected into frog oocytes. This ability to produce correctly processed and sorted proteins from a very limited amount of messenger RNA was very important in the early days of biotechnology. And if one looks at the methods sections of some of those early biotech papers, you usually find that the ability to assay and therefore to clone these important genes, such as interferons, depended on Sir John's observations that the oocyte, the spherical test tube as it's sometimes referred to, was very effective in expressing these RNAs. These experiments with oocytes and eggs were extended by Sir John to study the expression of genes. With Don Brown, he showed that purified animal genes, first the 5S genes, even before the advent of DNA cloning, and later protein coding genes, were correctly expressed when injected into oocytes as purified DNA. This stressed again that the signals that control expression must be directly encoded by the DNA sequence. As we heard yesterday, Sir John has gone on to study the logic of developing embryos, how signaling factors are distributed and interpreted to guide cell fates. In recent years, he's also returned, as we shall hear, to the question of how proteins in the egg cell are able to reprogram specialized nuclei. As we know, there are plenty of experiments that can be done in biology, but if one's to discern some sort of formula for success from Sir John's example, I'd say it's twofold. First of all, he's directly involved in the experiments, working at the bench with a small group of colleagues. Secondly, he's got an extraordinary focus on what's interesting and important. And though this may not lead, as he mentioned yesterday, to 5 lectures on the history of paintbrushes, it does lead him to avoid working on things that are feasible but ultimately not that interesting. He continually asks himself and his colleagues, what is the most important experiment to be done now? And also, what is the most interesting possible outcome from this experiment? Of course, the corollary of the latter is that if the best possible result is not that interesting, and one should move on to do something that is more interesting. So it's a tremendous honor to welcome Sir John to give the second of his Hitchcock lectures.
So thank you, Richard, for your very kind introduction, and indeed thank you for coming back today, very robust of you, those who were here yesterday, to hear the second stage of this presentation. And today the computer seems to be willing to work. Now this very dim picture, and it might help to have the lights down a bit, they get better than this, I should hasten to say, shows that I talked yesterday about how an egg makes an embryo, a fetus, and finally an adult. And so you go from an egg to a range of specialized cells, for example, blood and skin. And I mentioned that in the case of mammals, this remarkable option exists of taking cells from the early embryo, and they're called embryonic stem cells, ES cells, and they can then be put back into an embryo, so you again have a route to the to specialized cells through that particular variant. Now today I want to go back again, starting from specialized cells, and this red arrow shows that we can go right back to the beginning again, back to the embryo, and then follow through these various routes until you again get back to the adult, and this time you have different kinds of cells, for example, muscle and nerve. So, in effect, you can derive these kinds of cells, muscle and nerve, from completely different cells, such as blood or skin, and that's the sense in which you go from egg to adult, and adult back to the embryo again. And the real point of this, at the practical level, is to achieve cell replacement without immunosuppression. You know that if you receive cells from someone else, you will be unable to continue to accept those cells without immunosuppression, which is a serious disadvantage. And I'm going to be talking about this route in that direction. But I should say that these experiments, like many others, started with a purely scientific question, which Richard has clearly enunciated, that is, whether all cells of the body have the same genes. Now, the concept of replacement is not novel, and this picture, dating from 1495, shows that there were two saints, Cosmos and Damien, who, if you can hopefully see it better than I can, are replacing the leg of an individual here. There's the spare leg, curiously color-coded, and interestingly helped by two technicians who had wings, which I hope was helpful in the particular case. Unfortunately, this experiment has not proved to be reproducible, and we have to think of other routes. Now, there are a number of ways around this, and this is just to tell you what the four points I'm going to try and cover. I'll be talking a bit about replacement and regeneration versus the remarkable stability that cells have. Then I'll talk a bit about stem cells from adults and embryos, then about nuclear reprogramming with a view to therapeutic cloning, and then I'll say at the end something about the ethical concerns that may exist in this field. Now to some extent we get normal replacement, and these deer have these amazing antlers which can actually weigh as much as 70, 80 pounds, and they are regrown every year in a matter of 3 months. So there's an extraordinary ability in some cases for enormous amount of proliferation and replacement. And indeed, in ourselves, we replace our blood cells at an amazing rate. Indeed, you may be alarmed to hear that by the time I've finished, you will have destroyed something like 100 million blood cells. Happily, they'll be replaced. But then some of the parts of our body are not replaced. For example, the lens you're born with essentially stays throughout your life, and other parts, are pancreas and so on, are not replaced. So that leads on to the question of whether we have an ability to regenerate parts of the body that have been lost or removed. Now, this particular question also goes back a remarkable time in history, and this quotation comes from Hesiod, which was written at about the time of Homer, about 700 BC, and the only bit that we need to concern ourselves with is the bit in yellow, and you will see that it reads that the liver, I'm happy to look here, became immortal, and indeed it grew to the same extent every night as during the day the long-winged bird, the eagle, ate that liver. Now that's a remarkable discovery, and it happens to be true that if liver is removed, it regrows to the same extent as the amount lost. Now how Hesiod discovered that in 750 BC is quite obscure to me, but it makes the interesting point that that fundamental principle somehow seemed to be known at that time. Excuse me. Now, moving on a lot, we now know that in the particular case of the salamanders or newts, there is this remarkable regenerative ability. So if you cut the arm off at the forearm level, in the course of some days, that will completely regrow, as it also will if you cut it off at the arm level. It knows how to regrow the same amount. So that regenerative ability does exist, but we have to remember that when that happens, there is really no evidence that the cells which replace the missing part have actually changed in type. So when you get new muscle and new bone, the almost certain explanation is that the new muscle and bone comes, in fact, from the preceding muscle and bone, which was already in place. So there's no change of cell. You can, in effect, you can only hope to replace the kind of cell that was already present before. Now, the next thing I'm going to talk about now is the stability of cell differentiation. And we're asking the question of whether cells can change their state of differentiation. Now, the only really good test of this is to take one single cell and to transplant it into the wrong environment. You put the cell in among other cells that are not of its own kind. And that's because many experiments in this field have involved moving whole pieces of tissue, large groups of cells, to another site. And of course, those cells are largely surrounded by their own kind. And so you don't really test whether a cell is stable in its differentiation, because it may mean that it simply goes on doing what it was doing in the first place because it's surrounded by similar cells. So you need a different kind of test, and this is the one that I think is compelling. So in this experiment, there's an early embryo, and the red bit indicates cells which were destined to become muscle. They hadn't become muscle at that point, but that's what they were going to do in development if they'd been left there. So these cells are taken out and separated into single cells, and one single cell is then implanted into another part of the embryo, in fact, the bit that's going to form the gut. Now, when you grow that up, and in this case it forms an amphibian tadpole, this cell now finds itself, still as a single cell, inside the gut. And the question is, what does it do about that? Does it change its mind, or does it not? And the result is that it does not. And this is the actual experiment. That is the implanted cell. It's you can barely see it, but it's labeled with a fluorescent marker, so you can follow it. And this is the cells that normally form muscle with an antibody marker. And there is that single cell, cell that had intended to become a muscle cell. And indeed, it still does become a muscle cell, even though it is still sitting inside the gut. And this makes the important point that these cells take a decision remarkably early in life, really within a day of development, as to what they're going to become. And even though they haven't become that, haven't followed that route yet, they know what they're going to become and they won't change their mind. And generally speaking, that is true of differentiated cells, cells on the pathway to differentiation. They simply will not change their mind to a different fate as long as you keep the whole cell intact. And there are other experiments of this sort that show that even earlier than in this experiment, cells have made up their mind and won't change fate. Now, one explanation for that is the following, and that would be that in this diagram of a cell, the nucleus expresses genes, and the messenger RNA goes into the cytoplasm, makes protein, and some of that protein goes back into the nucleus and reprograms that genome to express the same genes. So when this cell divides into two daughters, this cyclic reprogramming ensures that the cells continue to follow the program that they have already embarked on. That's the a simple way of explaining why it is that cells enter a pathway and are extremely reluctant to change their mind. We'll come back to that in a minute, but I now want to turn to this question of stem cells in both adults and in embryos. Of course, what we'd like to do is to get stem cells out of our various tissues and use them for replacement. But they're actually very hard to find. And I should just explain quickly what we mean by a stem cell. So here is a cell, and a stem cell is defined as one which can do two things. It can either reproduce itself, go on continually dividing, making more cells of its own kind, or it can enter a differentiation pathway. So in this case, it divides, and one of the daughters follows the differentiation pathway, becoming, for example, a nerve cell or muscle cell. The other one remains a stem cell. And in the course of time, that one will divide again, and one of its daughters will go off and specialize, and the other one will remain a stem cell. So that's what we really mean by a stem cell. Now, people have been looking very hard for these stem cells, and I show this quite complicated picture from Helene Fuchs, where she was looking for stem cells in that recreate skin. Our skin reproduces pretty well. And the point of it is that the actual stem cells are essentially indistinguishable from others, tucked away in a little corner, almost impossible to find unless you use a battery of markers. And only with great difficulty can one identify them at all. And even if you have, to get them out is more difficult. And even when you have, they almost never seem to change fate and become something entirely different. So that's one of the problems of stem cells. Now, there's an interesting experiment I'm going to mention now by Helen Blau, where what was done in this case was to take patients, human patients, which were suffering from a hematological disorder, cancer, and to try to alleviate their condition, they gave them bone marrow grafts. And in some cases, the bone marrow cells were taken from males rather than females. In the course of time, these patients passed on, and they were able to look at the brain cells, in particular these Purkinje cells, which are rather recognizable, and they could tell whether derivatives of the bone marrow had entered the brain. In fact, that happened, though not frequently. In fact, they scored some tens of thousands of cells, and I think they found four, which showed derivatives of the bone marrow in the brain. And you could see, this was shown by using markers. The green arrow up there points to a little spot, and that is an indication of genes which are on the Y chromosome and therefore on the male, and the male contributor. The red one is the female chromosome. It showed that in some cases, bone marrow cells could actually contribute and become part of brain cells. And that's remarkable. One has to say, however, that it was an extremely rare event. And in fact, this was a fusion, and it doesn't actually tell you that the bone marrow cell was making any useful contribution to the Purkinje cell of the brain. It could be that it fused there, and the Purkinje cell didn't mind. It just accepted this without really making any difference to it. So that argues that this kind of idea of bone marrow stem cells may exist, and there may be cells in the bone marrow which can follow a whole range of different options, but it has yet to be shown that this would really be a useful route and that it would be in any way therapeutically useful. Well, now we move on to embryonic stem cells, and this is a remarkable field, and it started with Stevens and Pierce discovering that there are things called teratocarcinomas. These are really cancers which proliferate extensively, and they often form a whole chaotic range of cell types. You can see, hardly read it from here, but there you can see, I think, on the picture, hopefully, that erythrocytes, blood is formed, keratinocytes, top right, connective tissue, cartilage, bone, a whole range of cell types really chaotically arranged. Now, the remarkable thing about those cells is that they could be transplanted into hosts, and in some cases, they made perfectly normal cells. They even gave up their cancerous condition. Now, that was the background to remarkable experiments of Martin Evans in 1981, when he really discovered that you can do the following experiment. You start with a mouse embryo, making the early, there's the zygote, the fertilized egg, and then it makes the blastocyst. It's a bunch of about 200 cells containing the future embryo ones called inner cell mass there. Of course, if you leave the embryo, it'll make whatever it would, mice or humans. And you can take these cells and put them in culture where, amazingly, they go on growing almost indefinitely. And then what you can do is take these cells and implant them into a host embryo, another kind of embryo, when they will differentiate into the whole range of cells, every cell you can imagine. It's a truly remarkable phenomenon, and to this day we really do not know what these embryonic stem cells really are in a mouse. There's no evidence that a mouse has any such cells. Nevertheless, when you take these cells out, they will grow in culture, and they have this really extraordinary ability to differentiate into many directions. Really a kind of ideal stem cell. And in recent years, this has now been done in humans. This is a human embryo, the blastocyst and inner cell mass, and you can, with some difficulty, people have been able to grow these in culture, and some of them will remain undifferentiated, and other ones will begin to differentiate in different directions. Now, this is a potentially a very valuable method, and a huge amount of work is being done at the moment to try to find ways of getting a homogeneous differentiation of these cells. They tend, again, to make a rather chaotic collection of different kinds of cells. So I'm not going to pursue that, except to just summarize these points. So these embryonic stem cells have many remarkable advantages. They have a capacity for almost indefinite proliferation. They have multipotent differentiation. You can make them into everything, including germ cells, and you can freeze the stocks. Now, the disadvantages seem to me the following. They do tend to undergo genetic changes. Those who work with them will realize that after time, the stock has undergone various changes, so they don't really remain exactly how they were in the first place. It's hard to make them make some cell types, notably things like pancreas. It's extremely difficult to get them to go in that direction. They go very easily into the nerve direction, neural direction.
And lastly, if all this works perfectly, there is still the problem of immunorejection. And what that means is that when you hope to give a patient cells of this kind, they will be rejected by the normal rejection mechanism unless the patient is immunosuppressed. Now, that's not a good thing to be if you can avoid it, because you get all the infections there are around, and as a matter of fact, it considerably increases the probability of these cells becoming cancerous. So that's not an ideal route, but no doubt one that will be followed and will turn out to be progressively, I think, very useful. But I would like to now follow the other route that we particularly are interested in, and that's to do with nuclear reprogramming and therapeutic cloning, as we call it. So, first of all, what is the question we're asking? And what we're trying to ask is whether, we say, can we make rejuvenated embryonic cells from adult cells, and I mean of the same individual? Now, if you could do that, you would avoid the need, I'm sorry about the spelling, it says immunosuppression not needed, it should have said, means you would avoid that, because if you can have embryonic cells of your own genetic constitution, you would not have to be immunosuppressed. And the principle of this route is the nuclear transfer route, which has been mentioned by Richard, and the idea is the following: that you start with an egg, and I'm going for a while to talk about frog eggs, where this all started, but the principles are the same for mice and humans. So you start with this egg, and you actually use ultraviolet irradiation to kill the female pronucleus, the egg chromosome. So it's cytoplasm with no nucleus. And then you pick up a single cell in a micropipette in such a way that the cell wall is broken, but the nucleus is not damaged. And then you inject that broken cell, but with a protected nucleus, into this egg, where it essentially substitutes for the egg and sperm that normally enter that egg. And then you get a ball of cells, and eventually an adult. Now, this is the principle of cloning, because you, each time you do that, you start with the nucleus of a cell from an individual, and you get a whole range of individuals which are genetically identical, cloning as it's now called. This is not itself a novel situation, and this picture, which may seem wholly irrelevant, is actually a picture of a forest with bracken growing throughout this forest. And you may or may not know that bracken in forest is essentially one plant. It's all been produced vegetatively, so actually every bit of this bracken is all part of a clone. But in animals that doesn't work, and we have to follow this other route that I've mentioned, where you have to be rather careful in taking up a cell into a special micropipette. This has been specially forged under the microscope with an exceedingly sharp hypodermic tip and a smooth orifice there for the cell to go in, because you have to break the cell wall but definitely not disturb the nucleus inside the cell. And part of the skill is to make these special instruments, which of course is all done under a microscope, and then to inject the nucleus into the cell in such a way that you don't damage the egg, and hence the reason for this sharp point. So there is the pipette, and it's just grabbed hold of a cell, and it's a very old film video indeed, so I apologize for the conditions. If you watch very carefully, you will see something move up there. We'll see it later better. That, in fact, is a bubble of air which you have to put in the micropipette in order to decide when the cell at the end has been ejected into the egg. Of course, the inside of the egg is also invisible because of the pigmentation. So this egg has now received the transplanted nucleus, and in a moment it will start dividing into a two cell. In real life, that takes about an hour and a half, and here we see a sample of them. Now that one's going quite pretty well. That's got a two cell, as is that. And that's just now gone into the four cell stage. These ones didn't work, and that does happen. in a certain number of cases, for reasons we don't understand, it just doesn't work. Now, that one's getting on quite well. It's a good 8-cell, and I think in a moment we'll take a look at one such one. Here is one of this kind. It's beginning to divide, and these divisions occur rather frequently, about every half hour in this species, much slower in mice and humans. Now, in this case, you get a typical result where the cells on one side are dividing very well. In fact, if you look very carefully, you'll probably see this wave of division starts at about that point. It'll suddenly send a wave of division through the embryo, and then it'll wait about half an hour, and then another one will start and go right through the embryo, making these cells, essentially dividing the embryo into large numbers of cells. Now, you'll notice that in this case, there is no such division. That's a very common result of transplanting nuclei from specialized tissues where they weren't ready to divide. What you then do is to take these cells, the good cells, separate them again, and we'll see this happen in a moment, and then you retransplant, and here we are, here's the pipette, that's the air bubble marker. This broken cell has gone in the end, this will now go into an egg, and we may see the bubble marker move down. I think it's going to do it in a moment. There it goes. And pushing the nucleus, you hope, inside the egg, which will then now be able to divide completely normally. That's a perfectly good 4-cell embryo. And it will divide just about as well as normal embryos do, partly because the nucleus has now been, to some extent, rejuvenated and brought back to thinking that it's a nucleus of a normal embryonic cell. So that's how these things work, and we may wait for just a moment or two to see this division going on, these cells dividing very fast. Again, there's a wave of mitosis starting at one end and working through the embryo. Now, this one is completely divided. All the cells are dividing in unison, and that's the kind of one which will normally make a perfectly normal individual. It's got a few thousand cells at this point. So that's how the thing works. Now, just going quickly over the history, Briggs and King first did these experiments, and they found that by the fairly early embryonic stage, they got no normal development. We happen to use Xenopus, where although the success rate goes down, you do in fact get a number of embryos going through entirely normally, and I was lucky enough to get this as a graduate student, the first entirely normal adult animal in the vertebrates obtained by cloning. So this was taken from a gut cell nucleus, and it makes this frog, which was actually lived to 20 years, pretty good for frogs, and it laid eggs and everything else. And you can make clones this way. This is an albino a donor, that's to say an embryo that had the white pigmentation is used to supply nuclei, and that's why all these clonal progeny, which are males and therefore small, are white, even though they've come from eggs of the dark female. So that's the basic idea of cloning. Now, let me quickly go through the issue of whether this still works for specialized cells. Here is a tadpole with muscle, and you can take a single muscle cell out. That's the nucleus. This is the muscle fiber going right the way down through that cell. Transplant that nucleus to eggs, and you get essentially normal tadpoles. Here's one from the nuclear transplant, that from the control. And when you look, for example, at the eye of such a nuclear transplant tadpole, it's actually entirely normal. Lens, retina, but all these cells have a nucleus that was originally part, in this particular case, of an intestine cell. So the reprogramming does happen. The success rate is quite small to get normal adult fertile frogs, about 1%. Many of them form these partial embryos of just the kind that we've seen on that video. Now, you can use those. Here's one. You can take cells from this part directly and graft them into a host, like we might do for cell rescue experiments. There's the graft. It happens to be GFP labeled. And here are now the green cells derived from the intestine nucleus that are parts of perfectly normal muscle. Each one of those is a normal muscle cell, derived, however, from the nucleus of an intestine cell. So that procedure works rather well. You get, so for example, if you start with intestine, you can get muscle and nerve in by these various manoeuvres in something like 30% of the cases. And the main point I need to make now is that, as I said at the beginning, when you transfer whole cells from one part of an embryo to another, there is no possibility whatever of getting a reprogramming or switch from, say, intestine to muscle or nerve. But once you take the nucleus out of that cell, then by nuclear transfer, you get something like a 35% of them will switch fate completely to this new direction. So that's the principle of nuclear transfer. And the conclusion is that the nuclei of some differentiated cells are totipotent. You can get fertile adults, for example, from the nuclei of intestine cells. Functional muscle and nerve from intestine comes with a relatively high frequency of about a third. And the fundamental point is that there is a conservation of the genome during the cell differentiation. Indeed, if that weren't so, the whole idea of cloning could not apply. And now, finally, as was mentioned, this has been done in mammals with famous Dolly the sheep. This works remarkably well, and refinements, particularly by the Jänisch lab, have actually been able to go through with a genetically deficient mouse, do through nuclear transfer, gene correction, and finally rescue the animal by this route. So it's really a considerable achievement and shows, I think, the future direction for this kind of work. So the conclusions so far are that some transplanted somatic cell nuclei... I'm just going to go back a step. Now, I have to... let me just take a couple of minutes on this point. It's a slightly complicated point, which I'm only going to spend two or three minutes on, and a number of people will not follow this, but for the connoisseurs, they might be interested. The curious recent discovery is this, that if you start with nuclei from a specialized cell, transplant a nucleus, and take them into the wrong germline, like the intestine to your ectoderm, about half of the nuclei actually show a memory of the gene expression they had before. Likewise, if you start with the your ectoderm nuclei, transplant them with 12 several divisions, and take them into the endoderm, most of them nevertheless remember that they were originally going to be neuroectoderm cells, and they express such a marker. It's a surprising result, and indeed you can carry that on for a whole other generation, so that for 30 cell divisions, some nuclei remember their fate. And so the conclusion from this is that some transplanted somatic cell nuclei show a long-term memory of an active gene state, and this may account for some cases of abnormal embryo development, because we do need to explain why it is that only about a third of these nuclear transfers work. And that seems to be one important explanation for that. We don't know the basis of this remarkable phenomenon, but it may well have to do with the epigenetic marks placed on cells, such as the association of histone 83.3, being amazingly persistent. So that little commentary on the side leads me to the last part of the talk, where I want to talk about mechanisms of nuclear reprogramming. Now, the reason we want to know about this is that in the far distant future, I'm sure long after my time, it should in principle be possible to take a skin cell and to overexpress in that cell those genes which are needed to reprogram that cell back to an embryonic condition without even having to go through an egg. That's the long-term aim. But in order to achieve that, we have to know what are the mechanisms by which these nuclei are reprogrammed once you take them out and put them into an egg. So I'm going to talk briefly now about the cells that we call oocytes. These are the forming egg cells from the ovary, and they contain an amazing structure, which is this, inside that cell, and it's called a germinal vesicle, and it's a very specialized nucleus containing a large amount of material which is needed by the embryo for development. Now, these cells contain amazing chromosomes called Lamprecht chromosomes, the most transcriptionally active chromosome that's ever been discovered. A huge number of genes are transcribed enormously fast. So these oocytes are used to get a direct switch of a nucleus from one kind of gene expression to another without any replication or cell division in between. It's a very kind of ideal cell in which to observe and hence analyze this remarkable switch or reprogramming of gene expression. And I would say there are three things we need to do to understand this eventually. One is the reversal of epigenetic changes. I'll mention that in a moment. We have to understand the supply of transcription factors and what I call chromatin decondensation, which has to do with the making these genes accessible. Now, we found out recently that you can take mouse thymus adult nuclei, put them into the oocytes, and you turn on this stem cell gene called OCT4. It's a very important gene for making stem cells behave as such. So you can see the genes strongly activated a few days after transfer. The gene that these cells had on before is extinguished. That's inherited message. And so it means that you can, slightly surprisingly, use frog oocytes to reprogram mammalian nuclei. That's an extremely useful thing because of the huge abundance of these frog materials. Now, looking, just going quickly over this, one direction is that we find that one of the key events is this removal of the methylation state, the mark in these specialized thymus nuclei. This particular diagram, connoisseurs will appreciate, shows the removal of methyl groups from the promoter region of OCT4. It's a very important step in this reprogramming. This happens, oocytes can do it, and most other cells, very few other cells can, and we're really trying very hard to find out what is the mechanism, the molecules that reverse the process of this specialization. Step two involves the recognition of transcription factors, and this rather complicated diagram shows the bit of the OCT4 gene, the promoter region, to which a number of proteins are known to bind. Now this, because of the huge amount of material available, you can hope to find proteins that bind to these regions of that promoter gene. And in making this point, I should say that we have something like a million-fold advantage in using frog material rather than mouse or even worse, human material, to find out how these genes are reprogrammed. And that's because one frog egg is 4,000 times bigger than a mouse or human egg, and one frog contains 25,000 such oocytes. So it's a great thing, and I'll mention this again, to choose your material favorably. That's that route. And lastly, this thing of decondensation is rather remarkable. These are actually mammalian nuclei inside this germinal vesicle of the oocyte, and you will see that these enlarge. They've gone from a small thing to this really large inflated object, about a 10 to 20 fold expansion, and that is probably critical in enabling the genes needed for the turning on of these stem cell marker genes, the reprogramming, to actually work. We have to try to find out what that is, and one way of doing this is to find that if you take the proteins off these nuclei before you transplant them, you accelerate the rate of reprogramming, leading possibly to a way of finding out how to identify the reprogramming components. So that's really all I want to say on the, what you might say, the scientific side, but I've left myself, I hope, a few minutes to touch on this question of what we call ethics. Now, you'll know that there are objections to what science can do by some people, and I've been quite interested in talking to a number of people, particularly in the in religious people in the priesthood, about this whole issue, because I'm interested in why they should think, if they do, that science isn't the best way forward. And as far as I can diagnose, there are five reasons why people have reservations about this work. And these are the five. So one of them says, it's what I call the thin end of the wedge argument. And they say, well, we don't mind your putting mouse nuclei into frog oocytes, who worries about that, but what next will you do? And so we better stop this thing quickly before it gets out of hand. I find that a somewhat unconvincing argument because, for example, if you really wanted to save lives, you'd ban all transport, all cars and transportation, but we don't choose to do that. There's always an element of disadvantage to most advantages, so I'm not persuaded by that type of argument, rather tiresome one because it's not very specific. The second argument is the whole thing is unnatural. Well, of course, that's not a very good argument because nearly everybody will use antibiotics, which are themselves unnatural, and so if you're really going to object to this kind of work on that ground, you should not use antibiotics. Third argument I've heard is that God intends humans to suffer. Now, that's an interesting thought, but if you read the Bible, you will observe that there are a number of stories which are miracles. Now, to me, the bottom line of a miracle is to relieve suffering. They all seem to come out that way. People get better, not worse. And so I would say that that's not what God intends, at least as a judge from the Bible. Fourth reason is the killing of a potential life, and I think that's one that is particularly prevalent in among people who object. Now, their argument runs as follows. They will say that if you take, for example, the nucleus of a skin cell of you or me and put that into an enucleated egg, you will obtain an embryo, and indeed you will. They say that is now a potential human being, and you should not be killing that potential human being in order to make life a bit better for yourself with spare cells. That seems to be the essence of the argument. I find that an inappropriate argument for the following reason, that when you have mammalian embryos, mouse or human, there is, in my view, no possibility whatever that they can form an individual. And that's because of the process of implantation. Embryos which can be made, they'll develop quite well in a test tube, but unless they are implanted, there is absolutely no possibility, to my knowledge, that they could ever progress beyond that stage. And therefore, the argument is that these early embryos are not, in fact, potential human beings in any sense at all. So I would disagree with that argument. And the last argument I heard was this, which was, again, rather surprising to me. People said, well, it's good for us to see how others tolerate suffering. In my view, a rather selfish view, because they're saying we admire, as one does, people who put up with great discomfort, they themselves not having that discomfort, and therefore if we cured all these problems, we wouldn't have the benefit of seeing how people put up with these things. Slightly surprisingly, that came from someone in the priesthood, so that was that level of argument. Well, as you can see, I'm pretty biased on these things, but I thought I'd not like to miss the opportunity of making these points. So that's what I wanted to say on the on the ethical side. But let me finish with one comment, and I don't know whether we could have the lights up for a moment. It would be easier if I can see who I'm talking to. People often say to me, I'm not heard without this thing. People often say to me, why do you use frogs? I've talked about frogs a lot. Why don't you do all these experiments with humans, or if not humans, at least mice? Why, this is a completely inappropriate way forward. Now, my view is that science has progressed very largely by people choosing the right material. And I was very impressed when I read the account by Levi Montalcini and Cohen of their discovery of growth factors, the nerve growth factor. And you may or may not know the story, but it's something like this. They discovered that there is material which makes nerves grow extraordinarily actively in Hamburger's lab a long time ago. And so they pursued this, and finally they obtained an extract of material which had some nerve growth promoting activity. So Cohen decided very logically that he must find out what is in this extract. So he thought, well, the first thing to do is to see if it contains nucleic acid, so we will remove the nucleic acid. Now, in those days, a long time ago, one way to do that was to make use of a thing called snake venom phosphodiesterase. So he did the logical experiment and added the phosphodiesterase, thinking this might destroy the extract. Actually, what it did was to make the extract enormously more active, completely what he wouldn't have expected. Now, many would have said, well, that's a bad experiment, forget that. But he then said, well, that's amazing. It must mean there's something in the extract other than its DNA's destroying activity, which is important. So he thought, where do I get this from? Now, this came from snake venom, not an easy source of material to collect bucket loads of snake venom. So he then logically said, well, what is the snake venom producing gland? This turned out to be a thing called the submaxillary gland. So he then said, well, now let's look at rats or mice or something that we can get a lot of and make extracts of the submaxillary gland, which he did, and finally purified the growth factor. So I find that a very interesting story, and it shows that it really is best, in my view, to work with the most favorable material, even if it's not what you expected, to find what you're looking for, and then, of course, you can go back, as he did, and find out if that factor from the snake venom, the submaxillary gland, was actually the nerve growth promoting factor. And that's, in fact, what happens. So I like to persuade the people who I hope will continue to give me funding that phragocytes actually do have something to offer because of this extraordinary abundance of material. So let me just finish. I'm just going to summarize this at some little length, and then I'll have a little take-home message for those who find this rather tiresome to read all this. So what I've said is that, reading from the top, regeneration in vertebrates is really very poor, and the differentiated states of cells is extremely stable. Cells really do like to stay where they are. Second one says that adult stem cells are very hard to obtain. Embryonic stem cells proliferate and differentiate, but this would require immunosuppression of the recipient. We then said that nuclear transfer establishes the conservation of the genome and reprograms nuclei back to an embryonic state. And the fact is that this kind of reproductive cloning is subject to a lot of errors and is generally accepted, I think, by all scientists to be inappropriate for humans. Fourth one says that nuclear reprogramming requires reversal of differentiation marks, transcription factor supply, chromatin decondensation, and in my view is potentially valuable indeed for the possibility of cell replacement or therapeutic cloning. And you've seen that I have rather firm views on ethical concerns not being important. So, for the bottom line, the people who don't want to follow all this, I always have a final thought, and this is this. It says, what can be done usually will be done in time. So, where something is possible, scientists find better ways of doing it, and in my modest view, there will eventually be useful cell replacement through this route. And finally, the colleagues of mine whose work I've referred to, Henrietta Stanley, the single cell transplants, nuclear reprogramming, graduate student James Byrne, Stina Simonson, and all these are graduate students who have helped a lot in this work. Thank you very much.